Hello everyone, we might make a start. So my name's Cathy Nance from PricewaterhouseCoopers. So I'd like to introduce the session, Reducing Retirement Income Costs by Sean McGee. So for those of you that don't know Sean qualified 25 years ago and he's been working a fair while in strategic, managerial and technical roles for a range of organisations, from large and small life insurance and wealth management companies and super funds to his own business. So Sean was basically one of the key people that set up Ascot Consulting, or Ascot. What do you say? Ascot.
My accent is a bit different than everybody
else's. Right, okay. Ascot. And then he became a partner at Ernst & Young, and he's just recently returned to his own business, McGing Advisory and Actuarial. So Sean's based in Melbourne. He's had previous publications for the Institute of Actuaries covering office innovation and superannuation and back office, product rationalisation, modelling, internet strategies, strategies for friendly societies, insurance online and computer systems, and the life office actuary. When he's not working, Sean and his wife raise 4 children aged between 10 and 19. Sean's passion is, which you'll understand when he stands up, is for basketball, and he both plays and coaches, and he's also passionate about natural history and the Australian outback. So that's a little bit about Sean, and I think he's going to be reasonably provocative today on discussing retirement income costs. Oh, and just before we start, I might just give people a reminder to turn phones off. And at the end, I might get someone at the back, in one of the back rows, just to collect the forms as people go out, if you wouldn't mind. So anyway, I'll hand over to Sean now.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you, Cathy. Basketball is one of my interests, but getting a debate going is probably a little bit more interesting, especially for you guys here. What I'll do for the next 25 minutes or so, I'll take you through a bit of a presentation, and there's quite a bit of that around the background to the subject that I'm talking about. And I would very much encourage you to think up of hard questions during the process and then shoot them all to Cathy then at the end of the half an hour. So let's get going. Oscar Wilde, one of my passions is wit and wisdom. And I thought this was a very nice summary of a lot of the issues that we have in retirement incomes these days. The reality of pending retirement for most people. Okay, what will we cover today? Well, firstly, just to give you a bit of an overview, the aims of the paper are to identify and explore the issues giving rise to costs in retirement income and creation of retirement of income streams. And secondly, to encourage a debate on these issues. How can they be reduced? Some definitions set the scene. Retirement income after fees and other costs. Now, this includes SMSF, and it also does not include the age pension, so very much concentrating on the products and services around retirement income that a superannuation fund would provide, and the ancillary people in the industry, like administrators, etc. Costs, total cost to a member, and that includes implicit and explicit. And cost versus fees and charges is quite difficult in practice through the industry. So there'll be a certain amount of discretion, I think, across that. But at the end of the day, what matters is what is the member paying, either explicitly or behind the scenes, for the retirement income stream that they get. Okay, some retirement demographics. This is a great graph by a guy called Jim DiCarlo from AXA. He's on the financial advice side there. And the bars across on the left-hand side on the y-axis are the numbers of people reaching retirement age. So it's the numbers over age 60 at any point in time. And 2010 there is marked in the middle with red. And you can see how from very low volumes, around 20,000 for the last 60 years or so, they're now shooting up to the 100,000 mark very quickly, and that will be sustained for many years to come. So this is the baby boomer effect that many of you will have heard about. I don't know, how many of you actually work in superannuation per se? And okay, so maybe about half. So you guys, I'll be boring you to tears for the next 20 minutes. But the rest of you, there's some basic information like that as background that's quite revealing. Okay, so all those people coming through from now are firstly going to need retirement advice prior to their retirement and during their retirement, particularly in the earlier years. And they also, of course, will have a great effect on how much money is in the system in the post-accumulation stage. Now, I know some of you are down the back. Could encourage you to all come right up the front in terms of reading this, but can you see that down the back? You see the percentages? Yeah? Okay, great. This is one of Rice Warner's expense tables, which is probably the most quoted table in all of the Cooper Review. And if you go through many of the submissions, as well as the actual report itself and the Stronger Super recommendations that came out afterwards, this gets to the core of the cost debate in terms of data. So thanks to Rice Warner for providing that information. The key message here, if you look down at the bottom line, the percentage of all assets, it goes from about 20%, so this is the post-retirement assets go from about 20% of the superannuation pool or honeypot, depending on how you view it, goes all the way up to 35% in just 15 years. That's a big step in itself. Now, if you really want to get excited, you look at the next line up from that, and you see that the nominal amounts go from 214 million in 2009, which is the base point here, right up to 1.5 billion in 15 years. That's a factor of 7. So just get the sense of how this market is changing in terms of numbers. Okay, so some of the things that are quite relevant in all of this, obviously the regulatory environment and government policy has a huge say. Retirement income, pensions, very near and dear to any politician. Federal government have been quite active in this space. Every so often they'll come along and they increase the age pension if they think that's going to help their election success, notwithstanding the good intent beneath that in any event. There have been several inquiries. Cooper is probably the biggest of them, which reported the end of last year. The Henry Review also went through and looked at taxation around retirement incomes, as well as looking at taxation more widely. And then there was the Ripple Inquiry, which looked at the extent of good advice, bad advice, and what should be done to improve the quality of advice. So the Ripple Review has resulted in Future of Financial Advice recommendations by the government, which is currently being hotly debated in the industry. And I suppose you've sort of got two sides to that, as you have in much of the superannuation industry debates. You've got the industry fund side and you've got the retail fund side, and they're moving towards each other, converging, to use the term, with regard to products. But ideologically, there's quite a bit of difference there. So if we can get some debate going on the pros and cons of each side of that, that would be good too. The key message from Cooper is, for the whole superannuation industry, that there's an expectation, or they're setting the expectation, that fees could reduce by 40%. That's a long way, and they're the sorts of expectations that are being set among the public. The average asset percentage of fees and charges or costs to members in the previous slide, you won't necessarily remember that, but it's 1.21%, okay, was the current average as a percentage of assets under management. Now, 40% reduction there brings the average fee level down to around 0.73%. Yeah, that's big. But there are the expectations that have been set. Just to put things in perspective, it's reducing retirement income costs or superannuation costs is not just about pure costs. There's a whole lot of other elements. So value is really the key at the end of the day. But I think we also have to be careful not to concentrate too much on value if we use it as a crutch to get away from the fact that, okay, if we're going to get higher investment returns, it's okay to pay higher for it. For example, how much higher should you pay to get higher investment returns? And at the end of the day, do they eventually actually happen? And, you know, there's averages and there's dispersions around that. So I think they're the sorts of hard questions we have to ask ourselves in this sort of debate. Utility, security, risk for retirees in particular. How long are they going to live? You know, is it good that they live forever, or is it bad that they live forever? That's very, very basic, very basic questions around the financial side, which are different to the emotional and security side of things. So they have to be considered all the way through this debate as well. And in all of this, we've got to remember that the member's perspective is critical. Now, through the paper, and I would encourage you to have a read of the full paper when it eventually gets up on the website. I can vouch for the fact that it's been finished, and it's in the hands of the Institute, but it wasn't all that long ago that they got it. So I would encourage you to go back after these few days and pull it down. It's about 35 pages or so, and it does go into a fair bit of detail behind what I'm just showing you today. In the paper, I have the view from a member's perspective. So, you know, my aim is, well, let's see how we can reduce costs so that the member is better off at the end of the day. There's a fair bit of, well, what does that mean for the provider tied through things as well, because sometimes they're heading for the same goal, but sometimes if profit margins get reduced, or if there's extra servicing required because a complicated product is what's really needed, then obviously the goals are a little bit at odds at times. Don't spend what you don't have, and the less you spend, the more you keep. Cooper Review cost data is a good place to start in terms of getting a handle on retirement income costs. Now, one of the difficulties with writing this paper or getting into any sort of decent analytical debate about retirement income costs is that there's not a lot of information around. And that'll come out through some of these tables. Now, some of those might be a little bit tricky to see. I'll take you just through some examples of that. And remembering that across the different segments, there are very different business models in place, and there's a lot of complexity. So just take it in that vein. So we're exploring the subject, and we're really trying to get people to think and consider the alternatives. So I suppose nothing is ever as simple as it looks, but at the same time you can actually get to a good base by looking at the data that's there. Okay, so the first thing across the top of the page is the split between, say, administration, investment and advice, those three key areas. And then within that, Rice Warner, who have produced this table, have a platform element, and they also then just do a little bit of adding up halfway through there. What's worth noting is that the retirement income line here, which is probably just a bit more than halfway down the page, so it's within retail, and it's the third point down. So you've got retirement income, and if you go to the extreme right column, you'll see 1.84%. So that was what Rice Warner concluded was the current average costs as a percentage of assets for retirement income. A few things to note there. Firstly, that is heavily biased towards account-based pensions. 88% of the account balances, or the value of the underlying assets, was in account-based pensions. So really it doesn't give you an idea of what a diversity of annuity products or variable annuities or other guaranteed type options really cost. Second thing to remember is that the account balances for retirement income are going to be way, way higher than what they are for the accumulation stage. But you still have quite a high level of fees and charges. Now, Deloitte did some analysis on the international scene, and just some comparisons to give you a feel for things. Firstly, the international market is quite different to the Australian market in most respects, and the defined contribution area here is much more strongly developed than overseas. There are different government regulations, different government environments, so it's actually difficult to compare like with like. But just some percentages. On the Australian side, straight from the components in this Rice-Warner analysis, you've got corporate at around 0.71% in Australia and corporate master trusts at about 0.76%. Now, when you go to look at things internationally, the USA undefined benefit is 0.77%. USA defined contribution is around 1.02%. The UK is somewhere between 0.6% and 0.9%. But the Netherlands is 0.39%. So there's quite a lot of things happening there. Deloitte's conclusion was that, broadly speaking, for the bigger end of the market here in Australia, it's the admin and investment fees only, advice is excluded, were broadly comparable. That was as much of a conclusion that they could come to. So we're not way out of line in terms of the basic market. Give you a bit of a sense as how things vary according to the size of the account balance. And you'll notice, for instance, on administration in the third column there, if you've got more than $1 million on average account balance, then the administration cost is 0.01%, whereas if you've got less than $25,000, you're at 0.99%. And that makes sense, but that is the extent of the variations that they pick up. Okay, I'll keep moving through fairly fast so we've got time for a debate. What I did was I looked at the different areas where costs arise. So I've sort of come at it from a fairly systematic approach of looking at issues affecting superannuation and specifically retirement income, and then assess those from the perspective of where do the retirement costs arise. And I follow these areas of administration, investment and advice. Each of those can be tackled individually, and breaking down administration into platforms and the rest, and breaking administration down into back office, middle office and front office, just as a way of concentrating the mind, focusing the mind on, okay, for each of these areas, where would it be possible to save costs? So I call those the functional splits. Okay, I'll let you read that quote. Again, I think it's a great summary of some of the things that are wrong when you get into selling as opposed to buying in an industry like ours. But it's also incredibly true, and human nature is what it is. Selling around advice is probably the area that comes to mind in my mind when you look at costs, particularly the advice costs, which historically some retail members have allegedly received but didn't actually receive. And there's possibly an element in there as well on the platform side of things where, there's this quite sophisticated and expensive apparatus, but who's really gaining from that? Okay, that's the debate. There's two sides to every story. So, okay, some issues. Costs are too high. Lack of transparency. Too many clicking the ticket too often at too high a price. Cost and value of provision and rise of the SMSF. They're issues which I see as affecting the accumulation and the retirement income stage in various ways. And if we look at retirement income specific, then we can build off that base, if you like, and add a whole three more key issues that affect the industry at the moment. And one is retention of members. These are the sort of things that are concerning people because you need to retain your accumulation members or you're not going to have a base for selling retirement income and for looking after your members right into the future. There's a very limited product and service range. And that first graph that we looked at with the 20,000 per annum and now jumping to 100,000 per annum, so there's a good reason for not having a great range because, for one thing, there wasn't enough of a market there for that, but that's going to change radically very quickly. And the other area is issue number 8, the lack of government action to actually support more long-term guarantee-type products in the environment. So looked at all those issues. Then we consider the cost drivers. What actually affects retirement income costs? And I've listed out the key ones that I see there. So some of the major ones are scale and volume, and then around the operation model, the extent of efficiency line. So there are a lot of moving parts in this whole equation, but to actually get around to having the mindset of reducing retirement income costs, they all need to be considered. Okay, when you have a look at the paper, you'll see that there's I work through each of those 8 issues, and then what I've done is I've taken four areas where there are specific actions that I believe can be taken to actually reduce retirement income costs. Those key aspects then I summarise in a target minimal cost framework that I've set out. Okay, so as an example of an issue, firstly, costs are too high, scale and volume. And I'll just read from the paper on some of these to give you a bit of a sense. So Cooper said Cooper and several submissions found that scale is reflected in a lower fees as a percentage of FUM by entity and by member account balance. And as Cooper says, scale matters. The system is still immature for its size. So there's a lot of potential for scale purely from the demographic effect and the contribution effect going forward. Rice Warner also supported the extent of scale in that last table that I showed you, where you can see as a percentage of FUM, the higher the account balance, the lower the costs that are involved there. The extent of the scale effect varies according to admin, investing, advice, different across the board. What sort of reduction strategies? Okay, merge, acquisition, have a good member strategy, and you do try and cut down the cost of your developments, etc. So outsourcing, co-development. Second issue. Sorry. they got back. Gradually, okay. Going the right way here. Okay, so I'm sorry, I didn't realize I didn't have that up there. That explains the blank looks. okay, costs to a passive versus active investment. Juicy debate at the best of times. The figures in Cooper show that passive is much lower cost, and it's around 30 basis points for a balanced fund. He doesn't take sides. He actually pointedly points out that he doesn't take sides, but he also points out that the costs are that much higher. Some interesting statistics in the S&P SPIVA analysis that's done every year, I believe, and they've analysed the American market, the US market, the Australian market. They've done it across a whole bunch of different asset classes. And the general theme is that your benchmarks outperform your active funds. That's the general results that come from those things. So I'll leave it to you to delve into those. All the references are at the back of the paper, and you can just click through to the actual reports themselves and have a good look. And the one thing I would say here, of course, naturally the asset management industry has a vested interest in doing its job, which is active management, reaching for a better net return after tax and after fees. And again, I'll just say that the promise of that is one thing, the actual outcomes are another in many cases, but not all cases. So in terms of cost reduction, if you do move to more passive holdings, then this, say, like Australian Super, which is 50% of its equities in passive indexed investments, then there's a 15 basis point already. So now the 48 basis points for the 40% reduction that we needed, you're well on your way. And passive approach can also reduce tax and hence improve net tax returns if you don't have the same volume of turnover, say less costs, and less high gains, less than 12 months. Okay. Assessment three, government support for retirement income product diversity. That's one of the key messages from my analysis, is that there just isn't enough product diversity there. There's been a lot of research, and a lot of actuaries have been very involved in pushing that research along. So there's some great information out there. Translating it into products is really hampered at the moment because the government doesn't actively support. It's let the Henry recommendations sit there, their retirement income recommendations just sit there. You know, no action taken. Cooper refers to those as well. So all that is going on. The Institute of Actuaries, in its submission for the budget that it did at the end of January, and I think it published more widely, there was a press release on 17th of February, it basically sets out a whole bunch of requirements that it would love the government to take action on, which will free up this space and really give the industry an opportunity to be innovative. There was a comment this morning, I think, at the plenary session by Hazel McNeilage around our need to be innovative and our need not to be just looking internally at things or just picking up some stuff from overseas. We've got to drive this along, and a key step in that is persuading the government to change the rules so that we can, for instance, offer deferred annuities to people so that, you know, at 65 or 70, they can choose to have a deferred annuity from age 85. And, you know, worry about, eliminate the worry from that side of things, and then concentrate on, you know, doing well on the investment side between 65 and 85. So they're the sorts of things. So essentially, most of the recommendations I have are a repeat of the Institute of Actuaries recommendations with a few extra as well. So I'll go fairly quickly through the rest. So we've got the complexity I've mentioned. I think it's right there. And if we go on to further government support, what the government can do, I've mentioned some of these, but there's also things around long-dated, ultra-long-dated treasury bonds and ultra-long-dated inflation index bonds, capital bonds. They're all critical tools for our industry to devise products which have the asset liability matching, which will encourage people to provide these products which are desperately needed. And you know, as that first graph goes, will be even more desperately needed in 10 years' time and 15 years' time. Okay, the fourth one, I won't stay long on this one, so we can move on to the debate. Advice paid for by dollar fees. Now, the future financial advice recommendations, you know, eliminate commissions. They're recommending that members are asked to opt in every year. There's a lot of debate about that, whether it should be 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. One of the key things is getting to dollar fees. And if the industry adopts percentage of assets fees going forward, even if it is a fee for service, you know, in my view, we're only halfway there. Dollar fees focus the mind. They really focus the mind. And where it's not easy, that's the sort of focus we need if we're to be innovative. And that applies right across the board, the administration as well, but it's particularly relevant in the advice side. Okay, so taking those ideas and a whole bunch more that I haven't gone through here. It's another gem of wisdom. Okay, principles for a minimal cost framework. So what do we really need to focus our minds and the energies of the industry on reducing retirement income costs before they blow out on us, before they're on the radar in a much bigger way than just the superannuation accumulation costs that we have now. So I've set these out. I'll let you have a quick read through those. And they're pretty much in what I consider to be the order of importance. So first thing, we've got to make sure that we implement the current Cooper stuff and do that well, and then build from there. Okay, so a target minimal cost framework, sort of best practice type framework that you might have. Yeah, you're not going to be able to read that, so or at least certainly if you're anywhere down near the back, you're not going to be able to read it. So what I've done here is set out the functional areas down the left, the action to minimize your retirement income costs in the second column, and then some reasons and effects. And I'll just comment on some of those. Within the back office, I've got mirroring the stronger super recommendations. Having a strong member retirement program, for instance, is good too. Charging admin fees as dollars. And if we look in the middle office, that's where the product diversity comes in. So you've got having products which are simple, if they're of that nature. So account-based stuff, keep them simple, don't overcomplicate things, because complexity brings costs. But on the other hand, you do need diversity, and you do need longevity-type products to bring those in, but try and co-develop them. Or get to a scale so that you can actually make them cost effective and efficient. I'll leave that there for now because I'm conscious of time. Investment advice, the passive investment argument is in there. Another area where there is quite a lot of scope, I believe, is around investment management fees, where you get a base fee is a dollar amount, and then some element of performance fee for performance, but not a performance fee so big that it actually becomes that it undoes the good of having a dollar-based fee. Again, dollar, focus mind, do the job, get paid reasonably for a reasonable job. Okay, on the advice side, I think there's a lot of scope with the intra-fund advice that is now being encouraged by the future of financial advice and the other reforms around that, so that funds can actually give that simple base fee, standard fee, flat fee type advice, particularly in industry funds, for instance, where the balances are that much smaller and where you need something that people just won't get advice. On the retail side, I think it opens up a big opportunity for the retailers to actually offer those sorts of standardized flat fee, low price, relatively low price, and give a lot of value for that. So conclusions and recommendations. So just as in successful long-term investing, you know, there's no shortcuts in this business. You're not going to be able to do something miraculous overnight. It's a long, hard slog, and you have to put the work in to do it. I'm also acutely aware of the fact that it's very easy for me to sit up here and pontificate on all of this stuff. The real challenge is in driving down into the detail, working out what you can do to your processes, to the sort of products you come up with, and that's a hard slog, and that's what's required if we're to really be competitive on retirement income costs going forward. That's what's required. So conclusions, are some general conclusions. First, these are a bit motherhoody in some ways, but I thought best set them out. Yeah, I'll let you read those. Number three, the effective execution is absolutely critical. These things really come down to how well they're implemented. Good planning, good focus, and then do it, get on with it. And specifically in relation to retirement income, there's a good base coming out of Cooper, but it's all theory at this point rather than reality. It's not implemented yet. Providers should pursue scale via mergers and acquisitions. There's absolutely no question about that. And the trick is to find like companies with like incentive cultural fits, so that it actually is good for everyone and it works well. Passive investment will help reduce the fund fees. The government implement the Henry reviews and the Institute of Actuaries recommendations too on annuities and the like. Investment costs, set dollars, base dollars, not percentage of FUM. SMSFs I do cover in the paper, and they're a double-edged sword, I think, for the industry. They're potentially the saviour in terms of if they can be captured, particularly in the retirement income stream, with good products which offer longevity, their big account balances. If they're not part of the retail and industry, parts of the industry, then the scope for scale is greatly reduced. You know, they're a third of the industry in terms of assets. You know, they'll be pretty similar. They might reduce slightly in relative terms, but in dollar terms, of course, the whole thing just gets bigger and bigger. Okay, and low-cost, flat dollar fee. Low-cost, flat dollar, that's probably my mantra, I suppose, but... let's see what we can do with that. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sean. So we'll open up now for questions. So would anyone like to start with some questions? I'll ask the first one whilst you're thinking of it. So, Sean, the thing about can we really get scale, can we really get significant cost reductions in anything like the order that Cooper is suggesting? And some of the impediments that people have suggested might be a problem there is because there's been so much pressure on admin costs. It's been very hard for administrators who don't make a buck, really, to actually develop more efficient systems because
we're sort of screwing them down constantly on the admin fees, so they're not getting enough profit margin to reinvest.
Yeah.
And the other aspect is legislative change. We can't leverage global systems here in Australia because we've got such a complicated legislative structure and tax structure that sits around retirement savings. So to what extent do you think we'll actually realise some of the Cooper 40% reductions?
I don't think we'll get to the 40%, is my firm view. I think the complexity around the government regulations and the extent of tampering with it all the time is a real drain for administrators and for players in the industry. I think on the administration side, yeah, you're right in terms of it's very difficult for administrators to make a buck. I think scale does help that enormously. There are a few big players out there. I think that's been a very healthy development. I think there's, even if those, you know, sort of the two or three really big ones like, you know, the super partners and the AASs of this world, they will grow with the industry growing, and they have the potential to keep their overheads, at a not growing anywhere as near as the rest. So I think there is potential there. I think particularly for administrators, the whole idea of e-commerce, which is one of the core elements of Superstream from Cooper, I think most people in the industry, we just shake our heads to the fact that you don't have electronic commerce operating effectively. I mean, it really is crazy. And I think you need a government to come along and say, okay, guys, this is the way we're going to do it. And employers must give electronic records when they're paying contributions, you know. And it's very sad that as an industry we haven't been able to set those standards and actually make things work. And there have been several attempts at that in the process. But I think there's a lot of scope there, and I think that will help enormously in the diversity of products going forward as well.
Daniel Levy. I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that Jeremy Cooper's big, push in terms of costs related to consolidation in the industry. So it's the three accounts down to one.
Yeah.
There you go. Done.
So, but what does a $52 fee turn into when you reduce three accounts from $52 into one?
Well, you've just got fewer players in the industry doing it, so...
Yeah, but interesting on that one... From the accumulation side of the industry, that's absolutely right. From a retirement incomes perspective, there's not nearly as many retirement income accounts of the proportions. And I'm just speaking from experience and anecdotally now, not from any facts, because one of the problems with all of this is that there's the core data is not there to really get any further than was there.
Tony Boffinger, and for full disclosure, I work for Challenger, so probably not surprising to hear. How do you reduce costs in retirement incomes? Everyone should buy a lifetime annuity. End of story. That is the simple answer. But I guess, you know, to expand on that somewhat, Challenger, as part of its submissions to the Henry Review, got Access Economics to do some modelling work, which showed that... And we're talking about total amount that people actually earn here rather than fee they pay. But if there was 30% compulsory annuitisation, then the retiree is better off, the Australian taxpayer is better off, but ultimately, because it is a nil-sum game, there are people who lose out, and they are the funds management industry and the beneficiaries of the retirees when they move on. But given, you know, most of the beneficiaries of the retirees are going to be in their 50s and 60s themselves, given life expectancies, maybe they can afford to live without it. The next thing, just to say about costs and outcomes, is you made the comment about most active managers underperform the index. That's true. Having said that, it's good to have active managers because they're the ones that make the passive investments work. So I'm in favour of having people actually, some people actually doing that. The other thing, as far as outcomes is concerned, though, is that when you actually track through investors and how they make their own asset allocation decisions, you find out that investors actually wind up significantly underperforming that again. So for the vast majority of investors, a passive approach is the best outcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Sean, really, do you want to say something provocative on retail versus industry?
Where do I start? No. I think the whole future of financial advice change that's happening, I think, is well overdue, and I think it's very good for the industry. Now, I can also make the comment that I've seen the FSA in the UK say that banning commission there is actually, you know, it's taken, I think the FSA estimated it would take about 10% of financial planners out of the market, and it's taken about 30 or 40% instead. That's the way it's looking. So they're all worried that people aren't going to get advice that would have got advice earlier. I think, you know, that may happen, but if you're getting rid of the rot as well as some other innocent bystanders, perhaps on that, the greater good is probably served. The retail players are way ahead of the industry funds generally on this whole retirement income market, and that's essentially because most industry funds have only had people actually starting to take pensions in the last few years. So they're playing a bit of catch-up, and it also will be a long time before those members either get to, you know, sizable enough life balances, account balances, where they can actually they can look to have a sustainable income for the rest of their life, as opposed to, you know, a lump sum for that they'll spend over a few years and then they fall back onto the age pension. But I think there is a great opportunity in terms of retail and industry funds to give basic, you know, very, very basic good advice to members as they approach retirement and in early years of retirement for low fee. And I think also scale, you know, if everybody's doing that, so within a fund, then the cost can be spread, but it needs to be tied. That's not very controversial, is it? No, because this is several sides. Good man.
If you want something slightly controversial, in the scheme of what we're talking about, costs, self-managed super funds are a terrible idea. If you go back to your chart or table you put up about the costs per size of funds, then of course all the people up the top want to get out. You know, shift them out into their self-managed super funds, which are, you know, quite an inefficient vehicle for those people to be in. But they might get their own personal cost reductions. They get to, you know, buy their art and dabble and do whatever else people get self-managed super funds for. But all that does is, you know, it's the standard sort of thing. When you pull out the cheap bit that's cross-subsidising the other bit, the costs go up on the other bit, more people are encouraged to leave, and all that happens is that, you know, costs go up across the board because you're putting all of the stuff into the less efficient vehicle.
Okay, well, I'll answer in a couple of ways. Firstly, there's a very interesting anecdote that I heard the other day about these SMSFs, which is it's the modern version of the men's shed, which really gets to the point that people, you know, as they get older and they have a lot of their money and it is their money, they put the time and effort into it. So I think I disagree on some of your arguments around the efficiency or lack thereof. It's relative. Some SMSFs are inefficient. Those with lower balances, you know, the 100,000 or 200,000 balance, people have been I suppose, sold into those for various reasons. A friend thought it was a good idea. You know, maybe it's a local accountant or something like that who perhaps is not experienced in superannuation and the long-term costs. So there is perhaps a bit of misadvice in those areas as well. But I think once you get up to the higher levels and they have the investment power, in effect, in the market, They can be very efficient on the investment side through ETFs, for instance, through entry into some wholesale funds. If they have their own business property, they do cut out the middleman a lot. And I think that SMFs are a wonderful competitive tension in the industry. And I think it's really good that we have them, because the scale problem that you're talking about is very real, and it's going to get realer as we go forward. And I think the retail funds in particular, because it's mostly their money that'll go because they have the higher volumes, they need to be really careful to offer cost-effective services to those people. And I think the economics around retirement income products and product diversity, particularly around guarantees where you need a bit of capital, you need to really understand your business. It's specialists. You know, not everybody can go and sell annuities. I mean, you're the only one that's doing it these days, but there's there's a whole lot of reasons behind that. But it does take a specialization. It does take our actuarial skills in some of that stuff, because there's longevity involved, because there's guarantees. You know, that's complexity. But we need to get that industry to a scale where we can actually offer value, and value is what's missing. And the SMSF person sees value from doing it in their own. They get value because they're not paying a middle person, and they get the satisfaction from controlling their own destiny. That's the key thing. Thank you.
Any other questions, Kevin? Quick ones.
Sean, it's Capital Sullivan. Hypothesize. I'm a superannuation fund trustee. I like your idea about fixed dollar fees for investment management costs.
Mm-hmm.
How is it actually going to happen for me? Like, how am I actually going to get to the stage where I'm not paying, as my assets go up, I'm paying exponentially growing fees?
Yeah, I think you have to be very hard-nosed in your negotiation. And the bigger you are, the more hard-nosed you can be. And I think a bit like the passive versus active side of things, you go slowly, you go with a piece of your portfolio. And it is a bit, you've got to find someone who's willing, and maybe it's a startup, maybe it's a niche provider, and these things tend to build from small beginnings, just like the whole indexation thing started many years ago in the States. What would really put a cat among the pigeons would be if someone decided, a bit like Frontier on the asset consulting side, to come into the industry and say, okay, I'm going to run a shop that works this way. I think there's a bunch of difficulties, and one of that is just the way the industry is so intertwined at the moment. You know, that nexus has to be broken, and that's not easy. But if you've got a Murdoch or a Packer who say, okay, well, financial service in Australia is going to be a growth industry for a long, long time, I'm going to set up something alternative, and if they do it on a cost-effective basis, that's the sort of shake-up I think the industry needs, and it would be possible. But, there's not many people that have that sort of money.
One more quick one.
Paul Swinhoe. First of all, I want to acknowledge how hardy superannuation actuaries are, that if someone said to me 1 minute into a 25-minute presentation that I was going to be bored rigid for the next 20 minutes, I'd have been out the door. I wanted to support, I guess, Tony's sort of push for annuities. I think that you've talked about the sort of admin costs, but there's an enormous a great way of meeting the cost of the people who live a long time, which is take money off the people who die early. Now, annuities achieve that mechanism. Death duties achieve that mechanism, but that's never going to get up politically. We've got to find the right way of pitching it. So I support your comments around what the Institute's putting forward on that to enable more flexible annuities. to turn this into a question, have you considered, I guess, the cost of guarantees against the benefits of guarantees, as opposed to more flexible systems that have lower costs?
Yeah, in the paper, the only aspect of that I've particularly alluded to is around the transparency of those fees. So, products like variable annuities at present, it's not at all transparent, and it is complicated stuff. But again, we need to be able to communicate about the benefits and the values from those products. And you see things like fees of from 1% to 3% for the guarantee, and I think even actuaries who are not actually working on the product design find it pretty difficult to figure out, is there value for the retiree in those. So that's as far as I've gone in considering those things. Yeah, there was a lot of material just from the cost perspective.
Thanks, Sean.
I could have done that.
I think we're going to have to wrap up here. So okay. Thank you, Sean, for all your effort.
You're welcome.